This Week in Retronauts.
Go, Bard!
Hi, everyone.
I'm sorry.
Welcome to the next episode of Retronauts to enter your ear holes. I'm Jeremy Parrish, and this week we are talking about The Bard's Tale. And with me on this fine and festive occasion, we have, of course, that guy.
It's Bob Mackey. I'm Bard Simpson. Who the hell are you? I was not going to make a Simpsons joke, but then you did it, so now it's okay.
It's okay.
We're in a safe space
here. The seal has been broken. And also over there.
Big Barda. this is
Are
Roland
we the new
Kaiser.
Gods?
Yes.
All right. And finally,
I'm sorry.
Giggling in the corner.
This is Jason Wilson at GameSpeed, and I just have to say, Jeremy, that might be the most ridiculous intro yet you've had for a Retronauts.
Really?
Wow, I can't stop laughing. I'm sorry.
That's really saying something.
I know.
So yeah, this week we are talking about The Bard's Tale, and this is like our Ultima episode from a couple of months back. This is a roundtable discussion for half an episode with the same people. It's almost as though we recorded them back to back. Followed by an interview with the person responsible for the series, Michael Cranford. But again, instead of just dumping you guys into an interview with no context to say, like, here's a guy talking about a game he made, why should you care? We are telling you why you should care. And it's because The Bard's Tale is one of the I would say one of the early pillars of role-playing games.
It was innovative.
Yeah, it was a pretty big deal back in the 80s, and it kind of faded away. There were only a few sequels. There was a lot of infighting and a lot of just drama that happened that I think sort of cut the series' life short. And the creator actually left after the second game, so it didn't really survive until more recently when it's kind of come back.
There's a few lessons there, but one of them is get your contracts in order before you start things.
Yeah. And I don't really want to go too much into all of that because it sounds like it's pretty much water under the bridge at this point for the people who were involved. But definitely, like, you get the impression listening to people who were there back in the day talk, and you get the idea that there were some hard feelings, and it was a pretty tough situation. So that's why The Bard's Tale went away. But in its prime, in the mid 80s, it was way up there as like a must play RPG series. And I think the original Bard's Tale was like, for a while, was the best-selling PC game of all time or something
like
that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was. So what's great about The Bard's Tale?
Which, of course, you know, in the early 80s, that means it sold a few hundred thousand copies as opposed to several.
490,000, I think.
Okay,
was
so
the
almost
number?
Half
Pretty
a million.
Impressive.
So that's a lot. It's, you know, it was a smaller industry. So don't think this is like a game that, you know, sold 50 million copies or something. It's no like Tetris or Grand Theft Auto 5.
Yeah.
It's still very successful for its time.
Yeah. So its big innovation was music. And it brought in –
well, it was The Bard's Tale.
Yeah. And it brought in the Bard. Now, the Bard as a class of Dungeons & Dragons is one of the most fucked up things ever to come out of Gary Gygax and Dave Aronson. It was a mess of a class, very difficult to get into, very hard to play.
So yeah, actually, as someone who has not really played a lot of D&D and has never even looked at the Bard class, what the hell?
So it was kind of this amalgamation of, oh, it's a fighter. It's a thief. It plays music that gives you persistent buffs during your gameplay, and it was just kind of a – but it was this weird prestige class that was at the back. It wasn't even the Player's Handbook. It was in the Dungeon Master's Guide. So it was like, this is for advanced Dungeons & Dragons players only.
That's true for every game with a bard though, even non-role-playing games. Like even in Monster Hunter, there is a Hunting Horn, which is a bard class.
I know.
It is hard to wrap your mind around like playing the different songs in battle to
I've tried.
People. Yeah, it's
tried.
Rough. Like I want to learn that thing.
But yeah, this is definitely a game whose influence you see in the Final Fantasy series. There are
totally.
A lot of Final Fantasies with bard class characters and dancer class characters who basically have the same role that you see here. Etrian Odyssey also has it has like the dancer class, which does a lot of status buffs and enemy debuffs and that sort of
and
thing.
And then you've got the Chanter and Pillars of Eternity, which is a bard. Mm-hmm. But so what was – it was the first game to have a bard. It was the first game that had music as a spell. So if you think about the persistent buffs you have in MMOs today, that's what the bard songs were. there were things like the Traveler's Tune, and that was kind of like the, you know, part of the theme of the Bard's Tales. What fascinated me about this series was, in my youth, I thought I was going to be a musician, either a saxophone player or a tuba player. And so as I was studying music and all the school and playing D&D and playing all these games, what I loved about the Bard's Tale was the songs. And that's what really pulled me in. And every party I had a bard. And that bard was playing music. And so you played your music, and after you played your song, you had to go drink. So you had to go to the bar, get a drink. You could play again. And
wait, this was in the Bard's Tale or D&D?
No, both. Well, Bard's Tale.
Like the drink recharge, is that a mechanic or just like a thing you did for his narrative?
Well, no. You could only play it so much before you rest and had a drink.
Mm, okay.
So, you know, there were spell slots if you think about it in that way. The songs are spell slots. And so the spell, you could play them, and so they would have effects that would make you better in combat or improve your accuracy or, you know, help you with your strength and hit points. And no other game had done this at the time. You know, this was – persistent buffs weren't really part of what was going on with video games outside of combat. Now, in combat, of course, you had buff spells, but didn't have these outside of combat.
So you said music was a big factor in the Apple II version. That include actual music? I assume that there was no persistent music, but did you hear songs that your bard could play?
Yeah.
Okay, wow.
Yeah, and the Apple II GS was the best version of the game. It had the best graphics, which were just mind-blowing at the time. They actually, with the monsters, when they came up, they would move. Little bits of them would move. They have these animations. But it was the music, because at the time, it had the earliest inbuilt computer MIDI system that came with the 2GS. And so it had all the songs, and those songs were playing whenever you played the songs. And so, you know, when you're playing most of these role-playing games at the time, there wasn't really a lot of music in them. And you had sound effects, but you didn't really have music. So that also gave you an atmosphere as you're going into the dungeon. And if you put yourself into the roles of your characters and emergent gameplay there, no, one of the roles of a bard is to, you know, keep up your party morale. And when you're going through this big, dark, and gloomy sewer, it's nice to have a little ditty going on in the background.
So it's called the Bard's Tale, but technically you didn't have to put a bard in your party. Is that correct?
No, but it sucked if you didn't.
Okay. So it's one of those games where you really need the buffs and the elements that the bard brings to the party.
It helps. Mm-hmm. You don't need it, but it was punishingly hard. One of the things about this game was it had all the old tropes of these old dungeon crawls. It had the spinner traps. Mm-hmm. So when you go through you'd find a square as you're going through your dungeon, and you would spin. If you didn't catch the flash of the screen, you'd be going off in a different direction. It had teleport traps. It had these big groups of monsters. One of the big jokes is towards the end, you have a fight with 99 berserkers and 99 berserkers and 99 berserkers and 99 berserkers.
So it was like groups of
– yeah, four groups. Yeah. Four groups of 99, because it couldn't do 100. 99 was the cap on one group of monsters. And what's funny is the alpha for the Bard's Tale 4, which is going to be coming out this year, alludes to that very thing. And – the Bard's Tale had a little bit of humor in it, not full throat humor. It was more like, oh, you have to kind of look at it or kind of look at it. But it was in the way some of these monster groups were built.
Which made the 2000s game like a really
– oh, we're not
yeah. – departure.
We're not going to talk about that game.
Well, you're not a fan.
I hated that.
Really?
I hate that game.
Wow, because everyone seems so positive on it. You're the first person I've heard say like – the Bard's Tale for PS2 was not good.
Well, it was a PC game.
Okay.
Now, the only saving grace about that game is it comes with the old Bard's Tales on PC and on iOS. Okay. I assume on Android. I don't know. I don't have an Android. But yeah, I think that thing is horrible. But that's because I want it's a single player. It is totally tongue-in-cheek. Some of the jokes are pretty sexist. Some of the jokes are pretty stupid, in my opinion. The music component's cool. But
yeah, that era of game writing humor is not does not age very well.
No, I mean,
it's
early
from the same era as BMX XXX. So.
Yeah, and it's an action RPG.
You have to tread careful.
Yeah, and it's an action RPG, which to me is not the Bard's Tale. The Bard's Tale is a turn-based role-playing game, and the new one is it's turn-based under the hood. You have positioning, and it's a little different than the original Bard's Tale games, but it's a very good evolution.
Yeah, the original Bard's Tale games, you didn't see your party. It was just like text-based battle displays.
Mm-hmm. You know, it was might and magic. It was wizardry up to a point.
You definitely didn't see 396 berserkers at once on the screen.
No. You would see one, and he would be sitting there, and his axe would be moving. So,
so it did have animated character sprites in battle, but representational.
Yeah. And the other thing that I really love about the first Bard's Tale game was it took place all in one town.
Mm-hmm. Scarabri.
You're saying not like the real Scarabri.
Which is like the Ultima Scotland.
Scarabri. Yeah.
Huh? Scarabri is a city in Scotland, or like the ruins of a city or something in Scotland, right?
Ireland, I thought.
Oh, Ireland? Okay. Someplace in the British Isles.
It's somewhere in the British Isles. I'm sorry. You know, Russian Jew here. I have no idea.
A dumb American. I don't know.
Yeah. So there's a couple other things too that I really love about this as I've been digging into its history. I had no idea until I started prepping for this podcast. Larry Holland started with the Bard's Tale.
Yeah, I discovered that too when I was doing research. Like the key personnel, Michael Cranford was the original designer and the person
and
who
he's a fascinating character.
There's an interview with him at the second half of this episode. And his GDC talk was pretty interesting too. Other heavy hitters on the series were Brian Fargo, who people definitely know from Obsidian, and Larry Holland was the composer for the music. Yeah. So
Brian Fargo of Interplay, not Obsidian.
Sorry.
And then NXIL.
I always get those
and
two
now,
mixed
of
up.
Course, of course, now he's got his own crypto project going on.
Of course.
I knew we were going to talk about blockchain.
Damn it. Is this the first mention of blockchain on Retronauts?
I think so.
I'm sure it is.
I think we have to end the podcast.
You did it.
But you can't forget Rebecca Heineman either.
Right. She's next, yes. And I feel like the friction between her and Michael Cranford is something that still kind of simmers under the surface of things, even if they supposedly have buried the hatchet.
Yeah, I don't know. But you know, so after Michael left, Rebecca becomes – kind of the lead person carrying the water for the series with Bard's Tale 3 and Dragon Wars.
Mm.
Yeah, which, you know, in itself is kind of funny because the Bard's Tale is also one of the first early IP fights in role-playing games and in all of gaming, actually, if you think about it.
Mm. Yeah.
But, you know, getting back to Larry Holland, he did the music in the original Bard's Tale, and he went on to do the X-Wing series, and music had a huge role there. Now, of course, it's all John Williams' Star Wars score.
Right, but he came up with like the iMuse system, didn't he?
Yep.
Yeah. He was the one who like came up with the way that works.
Yeah, and so what's another great thing about the Bard's Tale was, you know, it's got this little tree of people who went on to do bigger and bigger things too. It was the first role-playing series that really challenged Ultima.
Mm-hmm. Outsold it at times.
Yeah. My Magic and Wizardry never really pulled that off.
Right.
So that was the other
thing. Wizardry had its fan base for sure.
Yeah.
And like I said in the Ultimate episode, like if you talk to sort of, you know, fundamental or, you know, foundational Japanese game developers, Japanese RPG developers, they're like, oh, I loved Wizardry.
Yeah.
But it was definitely like I get the impression that it was, you know, very much for sort of people who were RPG insiders, and each game built on the last one
and expected you to carry forward your party.
You couldn't play Wizardry 2 unless you'd beaten Wizardry 1.
Right.
And I think that was the case through 4.
Right.
So like this is –
that made it hard for people to get into
that. That can make sales so difficult when you have to have finished your 100-hour grind.
Yeah. That's like build your own long tail right there.
Now what was really cool about the Bard's Tale too was you could bring in your characters from Ultima, you know, which is your one avatar, or, you know, your group from Wizardry and play in the Bard's Tale, which was, you know, at the time very different. You know, you didn't have that kind of stuff. Each game kind of builds upon it. One thing I loved at it as at the time, the big D&D world was Greyhawk. And Greyhawk had a whole group.
I've never even heard of that one.
Oh, so that's the original world of Gary Gygax and Dave Arson. And that's the original one of the original D&D settings. And so all the named spells are wizards of that world. They were either player characters of the original groups or others that they made, you know, the Mordekaitans, the Yodelukes, the Bigbys. And they all had their spells. Bigby has his hand spells. You know, Mordekaitan had his mansions and stuff, et cetera, et cetera. And the Bard's Tale had a bunch of these named spells in them after wizards that had been in this world. One, of course, is Mangar, which is the bad guy of the first game. And that was another thing that called out to me is, you know, it was trying to build a narrative even with its spells.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I've heard of things like Bigby's Big Hands or whatever it's called and didn't know why it had that name. Now, knowing that makes more sense.
Yeah, and so then you get to the next Bard's Tale and you take a look at Dragon Quest. You've got your banks. Mm-hmm. Well, you know where the banks came? It came from Bard's Tale 2. And you could store your stash there. Bard's Tale 2 had casinos, which oddly enough were in the Apple games, but they weren't in the PC games.
Mm-hmm.
And you could go and you played like this derivative blackjack.
Those are also in Dragon Quest.
So, you know, you see these areas, and in the later games of the Bard's Tale, you're going through and you're visiting other towns or other dimensions, and you're assembling items, artifacts to take on the big bad at the end, which is in itself, you know, kind of a D&D derivative, but it's not something you really do in a lot of the role-playing games of the day.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the fact that this game takes place in a single city, but we didn't really build on that. Yeah, the first one.
Yeah.
So can we kind of talk about how that fits into the evolution of RPGs at the time? Because, you know, you had wizardry like we talked about in the Ultima episode, which was just like keep going deeper into the dungeon.
Yeah.
Or Wizardry 4, which was get out of the dungeon.
Yeah.
But it was a dungeon. Whereas Ultima, you know, started introducing towns and like world map and, you know, a much bigger world. Whereas this kind of feels like it splits the difference. Like there is the city on sort of the outside, and it does break the dungeon aspect into multiple pieces.
Yeah. And it kind of progresses. The town is where the first place where you can fight to get experience. You fight the low-level monsters, your orcs, your hobbits, because at the time
hobbits aren't violent. What?
Oh yeah, you fought groups of hobbits. You fought groups of everything in those days. And
you can kick puppies too. Why not?
Well, you didn't kick puppies, but they fought dogs.
No, I'm just saying, like, you know, if you're gonna fight hobbits, you might as well kick puppies.
Yeah. But that was like, you know, and another side is, you know, in some games you had hobbits, some games you had halflings, some games you had bobbits, et cetera. You know, everyone played with the language back then.
Mm.
In a way, they did it with dwarves and elves and other races. And then you would go to your first dungeon, the sewers, which would be underneath a plate.
I think I hear the bard.
That's not me. I'm not whistling.
Someone's buffing us. It's great.
And then you go from one dungeon to another. That's in other locations of the town. At the same time, you know, you have your adventurer's gear where you go to save your game, because at this point you couldn't just save anywhere in an RPG. And you had your store, Garf's Equipment Shop. He had a name, which I also loved. And you'd go in there and he would buy and sell stuff. You had to go to a temple to go get healed or get your levels restored after an energy drain attack or other things. And then the Adventuring Guild is also a place where you could go level up. You couldn't just level up in the dungeon. You had to come out, you had a little plus next to your name or asterisk, and then you'd come out and you'd level up. And so you'd go from there, you'd go, you know, sewers, there'd be the catacombs, there'd be Clarion's Tower. Clarion was a wizard of renown in this world, going up all to Mangar's Tower, which was also in town. So, and then, yes?
This seems like it's the sort of progenitor of the Gold Box game.
Yep, that's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. This sounds a lot like Pool of Radiance.
Right. Which,
well, yeah, but you got to remember Pool of Radiance too. You had an adventure module from D&D in it.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I mean Pool of Radiance was, you know, that was about bringing real D&D into video games.
Yeah.
But like the idea of being in town, some zones of town are not that safe, and you're going to find different key, you know, mission components within the city. Like that's very, very Pool of Radiance, except Pool of Radiance, of course, didn't have like the text display for combat. It's more of like an Ultima 3 style combat where it's positional.
Tactical instead of the menu based.
And the Gold Box games are themselves fascinating. We should discuss at some point.
Oh, yeah. We should definitely have some Gold Box episodes.
But so that was, you know, it all took place in this one town, Skybrae. Mm-hmm. And then the next game, you go visit other towns. And then in Bard's Tale 3, you're going to other dimensions. And these dimensions, you know, the apocalypse has happened in Bard's Tale Scarbrazen mm-hmm. Ruins, you know, the Mad God Tarjan, which was – is the bad guy who's doing all of it, is – has taken over. But then you're going to other realms, and one realm is an elf realm where everything's great and there's no apocalypse. And it's like, oh, well, why don't we just move here, you might think. But you know, that's a part of the game progression. And you know, there's a land that's all of the dwarves. And then there's another land you go to that has a city of gnomes. And as you're going through these artifacts and – but you take a look at the Bard's Tale 3 and, you know, Final Fantasy fans here, geomancy, chronomancy comes from Bard's Tale 3.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, I didn't realize the Bard's Tale series expanded so much. I'm really only familiar with the first one.
Yeah.
But going beyond the bounds of Scarabrae to like a huge world and other dimensions even.
Yeah, and then what's really interesting about the Bard's Tale 3, that's where Rebecca Beheineman takes over from Cradford after Cradford leaves to go get his philosophy and theology degree.
Yeah, I found that fascinating. I never hear anyone leaving Games for Academia. I hear the opposite all the time. That's what I did. But I never heard that before. So you know, I guess he was into it. He was a devout Christian or is a devout Christian.
He was devout. And, you know, names of some of these cities are coming right out of the Bible.
Yeah, that's something in the interviews portion of this this podcast. He talks about like how he just kind of took names out of the Bible and was like, I'm sure someone's going to call me out on this, and no one ever did.
Just like so Evangelion. Like,
all right. Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and which is an interesting contrast to the moral panic at the time that was going around role-playing games and Dungeons & Dragons in particular. You know, you didn't see that with the Bard's Tale, and it wasn't because it was, you know, he had some Christian elements to it. No, it was just because – you know, the moral panic police never got to the Bard's Tale.
Well, you know, it's also – you look at the cover of it and it you know, a nice little bard in a dungeon type thing. It's not like the giant demon on Ultima 3 or –
Yeah. But what's interesting also about the Bard's Tale 3 is it's the first one to have an auto mapping, which was at the time revolutionary. And now you have games where they do the maps automatically you can turn it off.
Yeah, you have a series, Etrian Odyssey, which exists entirely to say, no, we've taken away the auto map and you have to do it. That's the selling point, is that it doesn't have the feature that every other game has had since Bard's Tale 3.
Yeah, and then the Bard's Tale 3 is also where a fellow named Michael Stackpole comes in. Mm. And some of you might know him for other things he did in games, other
X-Wing
things he
novels.
Did in role-playing, or novels. He's become quite a prolific author.
I did not realize he got a start in games, actually.
Yeah.
I thought he was just like the guy who was like, I love me some
video games and
I love
Dungeons
me some Wedge Antilles, and I'm going to write about Wedge Antilles.
No, he started his writing credits with games like The Bard's Tale and Dungeons and Dragons.
That's interesting.
And now he's, you know, quite an accomplished author.
That's a double X-Wing connection right there.
I know, isn't
it? That's interesting.
Yeah, it just goes to show you that, you know, Origin, you know, made all these great developers. You know, you have the same thing with Sirtec, with Wizardry. And then, you know, Interplay had its own lineage of strong developers as well.
Yeah, and of course, Interplay did a lot more than just The Bard's Tale, and we can talk about that some other episode. But yeah, like there are several of these companies that you look back and you're like, so much came out of these. I guess I didn't realize Bard's Tale was quite so
it had its names.
So fundamental, so formative.
It had its names. Yeah. And it was, you know, totally overshadowed in some ways. The Bard's Tale series never got its true conclusion. It had a game called Dragon Wars. And what's really funny about that was, okay, well, they couldn't use the Bard's Tale name because of conflicts with EA. So they make Dragon Wars and –
wait, so what's the conflict with EA here? Did EA buy Interplay?
EA held the license for the series as the publisher.
Okay. Yeah. So they published the game and that was one of those check your contracts things.
Mm-hmm. And so what was interesting here is the game's almost done. There's no dragons in it. It's kind of ripping off the kind of myth of Gilgamesh in some very loose ways. And so at the end, Rebecca Heinemann's adding dragons to it. So they can have dragon wars.
Oh, yes, that's right. There's no war and there's no dragon.
Yeah. Now the game got very good reviews and it got very good reception. And some of the elements that we had talked about from the earlier games have made it into it. But, you know, the fact that it didn't have the Bard's Tale name, even though it was in many ways a continuation of Bard's Tale, was kind of sad. And now we have the Bard's Tale 4 coming out for sure. What was cool about Dragon Wars is Wasteland was the first RPG in my recollection where you're actually using skills, character skills. And it brings in some of that interplay. So, you know, they're working there hand in hand, you know, and you're using, you know, oh, you can swim. That helps you get across some water, and strength lets you help a stone. And, you know, your skills play an important part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that hadn't really been in role-playing games up until Wasteland.
Right.
And so it continued along with that spirit and the other things, the auto-mapping, it goes on there too. But yeah, that was what was interesting about Drag Wars to be. And then the series is just gone.
I found it pretty fascinating. I know we're running out of time in my research though, but they had Bard's Tale had sort of a Mario Maker release where they
it
had
did.
A construction set.
A Bard's Tale construction set.
Does that predate – like I know it predates RPG Maker. Does it predate like any sort of thing like this?
The original construction set was Pinball Construction Kit.
Well, I mean in terms of RPGs.
83.
I meant in terms of RPGs.
There was one called the Adventure Construction Set.
Okay.
Which I can't remember which year it came out, but I used to make basic role-playing games in it. And then I would have my brother play it and make him cry.
I guess it just shows how popular this was because now there's software for people to make their own and distribute their own Bard's Tale games.
Yeah. And at the time, it was kind of like this little theme. You know, there was also one for the Gold Box games, the Limited Adventures, where you can make your own games. And at the time, you could spread around on Usenet and other bulletin boards.
People are still making things in that.
They are.
I believe it.
I mean, there's still some great music coming out of Mario Maker. So, or not Mario Maker, Mario Paint.
And there's still new Doom mods every day. Mm-hmm. So go nuts.
Yeah. But, you know, that's another thing that I love about some of these older series was, you know, the Gold Box games, Bard's Tale. You know, it was like, okay, well, you know what? Here's some tools. Make your own adventures. And that's something that a lot of games never let you do still. You know, and we're lucky that, you know, modding has been embraced by so many role-playing game developers over the years. But at the time, it was a kind of a new thing. Hmm. But, you know, technology was evolving then and there was no internet to spread them on widely at the point. So, you know, you could make games like my brother and I just made stuff for each other.
So kind of as we wind this episode down or this portion of this episode down, I'm curious to know what you guys have experienced in terms of the Bard's Tale. Like what has been your relationship with the games? How did you discover it? That sort of thing. I'll start. I haven't really played that much Bard's Tale. I did play some of the NES version in 1999, 2000, just out of curiosity. But
I never touched that.
Yeah, it wasn't really optimal. It's interesting because I believe my interview with Robert Woodhead will have been published by the time this episode comes out. And he says, much to my surprise, that the NES version of Wizardry 1 is the definitive version in his mind, like the best version.
I had no idea.
Yeah, I was like, But yeah, he said he like really thinks it turned out well and really liked the, you know,
like
that version.
I love how the NES became such a phenomenon that became the place to port.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't feel that that was necessarily the case with the Bard's Tale. It was a different publisher, like ASCII did Wizardry, and I'm pretty sure FCI Pony Canyon also did.
It was them, yeah.
They did Bard's Tale, they did the Gold Box games, they did Hillsfar, they did the Ultima games. So they had a lock on this stuff. I think it was all through EA, but They didn't do a good job with it. But anyway, that was pretty much my experience aside from, you know, like dabbling a little bit with the 2004 Bard's Tale or
non-canonical.
What about you, Bob?
I had the exact same experience as you. I bounced off of the NES version. Again, too complicated for me. And I've only really known about it in terms of it being very influential, but I never actually went back. I can play some old games, but I feel like old RPGs, there's something extra crusty about them that makes them extra hard to break into. So like that's sort of where I draw the line.
They're not forgiving.
Yeah. They're not forgiving. They're hard. You die a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Especially in the Bard's Tale. You die a lot.
Rowan, what about you?
So when I mentioned the box was non-threatening, it actually ended up threatening my weird family. Well, threatening is not quite the right word, but like for whatever reason, like I would go to, you know, the local GameStop and I'd be like, I want this RPG. I want this RPG. But when my mom saw this one, she said, no, you can't play that until you have read like the Arthurian legends. I don't know what triggered that in her. Like all of these have, you know, some sort of Arthurian, you know, symbolism
now,
going
the,
on.
Now, the box for the Bard's Tale had a bard in an inn playing, yeah. And then it had kind of this background of a map with all these symbols on it.
Yeah, I don't know what made her think that. So I did not like, as I was playing all the Gold Box games and
which is Ultimas all Larry Elmore
and,
art,
all these things that like were just like, give me all the
Larry
RPGs
Elmore
you have. The Bard's Tale, I only came to much later and was not able to like fully throw myself into it in the way that I might have had I grabbed it in 1987 or whatever.
So my two series that I really fell in love with were Mighty Magic and the Bard's Tale. Those were my two, and the Bard's Tale was my favorite. That's the one that when I think about my nostalgia for games of yesteryear, that's what I think of.
Hmm. But how did you discover the Bard's Tale?
When we bought an Apple IIgs.
I think, yeah, you mentioned that.
My dad bought an Apple IIgs and it came with a bunch of games that he bought from the person, including the Bard's Tale games.
Okay, okay.
And that's how I discovered it.
So it was sort of passed along from a previous owner.
Yeah, yeah. We bought an Apple IIgs like 8 months after it came out from some group in Guerneville.
Hmm. Okay. I got married in Guerneville. That's all I know. That's all I can tell you about.
What's a Guerneville?
It's a place where they make cheese, I think.
Okay. So Guerneville is in Sonoma County, wine country.
That makes sense.
It's right off the Russian River.
It's the gay mecca of Northern California.
Oh, that's right.
But Jeremy, you got straight married.
I did. It was weird. They were like, what?
It's gentrified.
Oh, we don't understand. No. It wasn't actually in Guerneville. It was like 5 miles outside of Guerneville at an inn. But anyway, it's a really pretty area, but it's not where I would think like get a hot new used Apple IIgs.
Well, what was funny was it was out in West Sonoma County. I lived in grew up in Santa Rosa. That there was this Apple II user group that took root.
Okay, back in the days of AMUG and things like that.
Yeah, it was and so that's where my dad got it. He ostensibly got it for my mom to help run the business that my dad had, and it became where we did our homework and played our video games, as most computers probably did in the 1980s.
I'll use this as a digital Rolodex for my recipes. No.
Lots of things were sold through – lots of computers were sold through middlemen instead of big box stores back then, right? Like your,
like your
Apple dealer or whatever. Ask your Apple dealer.
Well, you still see some of those signs on some of these computer shops, you know, Apple dealer. And there was this one that was all the way out on West Santa Rosa that was this big Apple dealer for years, and I don't think it's there anymore, but it was there for, you know, I think until about 3 or 4 years ago.
All right. So
– for the, you know, very small segment of Santa Rosa listeners to Retronauts.
Yeah. Okay. So we are out of time for this segment of the episode, but I did want to thank you guys for coming in to talk a little bit about Bard's Tale. Yeah, I guess there aren't quite as many games as in Bard's Tales series, like the umbrella, as there are for Ultima. So I feel like we had a
Mighty Magic or Wizardry.
Right. We had a pretty thorough discussion here. But definitely worth exploring Bard's Tale 4 when it comes out, hopefully later this year.
Yeah.
And there's also the Mage's Tale, which is like a VR.
It's a VR kind of riff on the Bard's Tale world. And I haven't played it. Because I don't have a lot of time for VR games. Don't have a lot of time for any games anymore. Mm-hmm. But you know, people who have played it say they really enjoy it because you're, you know, it's Harry Potter-ish.
but better than the Harry Potter mobile game.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, so yes, that wraps it up for this segment of Retronauts. Stick around for the second half of this episode where Michael Cranford will tell you all about The Bard's Tale in his own words. In the meantime, I have been Jeremy Parrish and these fine people here with me. Jason, why don't we start with you because you definitely carried this episode.
I'm Jason Wilson, the managing editor at GameSpeed, where when I do write, it's usually about RPGs. You can find me on Twitter talking about RPGs and all kinds of other things that annoy the hell out of me at Jason_Wilson, and that's all lowercase.
Rowan?
I am also at GameSpeed. I am the PC guest post editor, and I am on podcasts like 3MA and Secrets of the Universe and now this. And I am Rowan Kaiser, all one word, on the Twitters, where you can usually find me yelling about Ultima.
And the NBA.
Both. Oh, is it my turn?
It is your turn.
Okay, hello. It's Bob Mackey, everybody. Find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. And I do other podcasts as well. Those are Talking Simpsons, a chronological exploration of The Simpsons, and What a Cartoon. That is an exploration of every cartoon every week, a different cartoon of a different series. So look for both of those and whatever you listen to podcasts with. And my and
have you
my,
done Mask yet?
No, we have not.
But, I hope you don't.
Okay. I will take that off the list. I don't think it was on the list.
Call me when you guys do G.I. Joe.
I will. You'll be on that one. But yeah, I have my own Patreon with the great Henry Gilbert. That's the Talking Simpsons Patreon, patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. If you go there, for a measly $5 a month, you can get exclusive series like Talking Critic. We went through the entire series of The Critic, Talking Futurama, all season one of Futurama, and tons of exclusive podcasts, including interviews with Simpsons writers and showrunners, a community podcast, and specials and things like that. So yes, that's patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. Thank you very much.
And finally, I am again Jeremy Parrish. Yeah, you got that part. Retronauts, though, you didn't get this part. Retronauts is at retronauts.com. It's a podcast you can download. Retronauts.com also has other things that aren't podcasts that you can read. You can fill your eyes and ears with Retronauts. It's amazing. The show, of course, is supported through Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. You can subscribe, get early access to episodes, get better bitrate quality. It's great. We love you. Thanks for supporting us. Thanks for listening. Please stick around for the second half where Michael Cranford will once again tell you why The Bard's Tale is the coolest thing he ever did. So thanks, guys.
GameFly is the best way to buy and rent all your favorite games. GameFly puts video games where they belong, in the hands of the gamers who love them. With your monthly subscription to GameFly.com, you can pick your favorite games from more than 9,000 titles and have them mailed directly to your door. Don't waste your money buying this year's new game titles before you know if they're worth it. With GameFly, you have access to all the newest game releases, and you can keep them to play as long as you want. For one monthly fee, you get unlimited game rentals of all the most popular titles from Madden to Mario. It costs as little as 54 cents a day, there's always free shipping, and you can cancel any time. You can keep the games as long as you want, and there are no late fees or due dates ever. When you're tired of one game, just mail it back, and they'll send you a new one of your choosing. You never have to leave your house or worry about the game you want being out of stock like happens at your local retailer. And they offer movie rentals, too. So go to gamefly.com/retronauts and start your free premium 30-day trial today. The premium trial allows you to check out two games or movies at a time. You could only get this offer by visiting gamefly.com/retronauts. The usual first free month offer is only one game at a time. So go sign up now and start playing all your favorite games absolutely free for 30 days.
The truth is most of us are brushing our teeth wrong, not for long enough, and forget to change our brush on time. That's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. So what makes Quip so different? For starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes, while still packing just the right amount of vibrations to help you clean your teeth. Quip's built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist recommended 2 minutes with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. Next, Quip's subscription plans are for your health, not just convenience. They deliver new brush heads on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth. And finally, everyone loves Quip. They were on Oprah's O-List, named one of Time's best inventions, and is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Plus, they're backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers use Quip every day. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/retro right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/retro. That's spelled GETQUIP.com/retro.
Pluto TV is the leading free streaming television service. Watch more than 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all for free. No credit card needed and no sign up. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies. What are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again. Download Pluto TV for free on all your favorite devices today. New to Podcast One, it's Trials of the Vampire, straight out of Australia. When a male prostitute is accused of assaulting and mutilating a client, few doubt his guilt. The attack was shocking, and the victim claims the attacker boasted about being a 200-year-old vampire. To hear the whole story, you must go to podcastone.com or make sure you get the new Podcast One app. It's a story you don't want to miss. So for this segment, I'm here at Game Developers Conference 2018 with Michael Cranford, the designer and programmer for the legendary RPG, 1984 RPG? 84, 85.
I'm not...
The Bard's Tale, yeah. Right. And you gave a presentation yesterday, a postmortem on the creation of the game and the development, and it was a pretty interesting talk. We'll probably cover some of that ground. So that may be, you know, sort of old hat for you, but I think most people listening to this were not at the panel, so
right.
It'll sure. be fresh to them. But I'd also like to talk to you about, you know, the sort of place that the Bard's Tale represents in the development and evolution of video game RPGs, and you know the inspirations you brought into that, and you know as someone who was sort of there on that first or second wave of CRPGs. How you took that raw concept of role-playing games and adapted that into the limitations and capabilities of computers. To me, that's really interesting, is taking this sort of abstract concept from really another format and turning it into, you know, something that worked on a computer. So, yeah, if you wouldn't mind giving just like a little bit of background on yourself and kind of, I guess, maybe how you got into RPGs in the first place.
Well, I was always a really prolific science fiction fantasy reader as a kid growing up. So my interest in the whole area and the genre was inspired by that, The Hobbit, Lord of the Rings, and then from there into just a diverse range of different authors I read all the time growing up. I didn't watch TV very much. And I think I became first connected to it through a play-by-mail game company. I had some advertisement or something, Flying Buffalo out of Arizona, and they had a spin-off on D&D called Tunnels and Trolls, and they had solo adventures. So I happened to get some of those, and I think I might have wandered into a gaming store, actually, and seen some of their material. And that's where I first got exposed to it and started becoming really interested. And it was the sort of solitaire adventures that were at first interesting to me, that I could play, interact with the game, and I didn't need anyone else. At that point, I didn't know anyone else that played these games. But then over time, I became aware that there were other people interested in it, and started doing some Dungeons & Dragons tabletop stuff and getting involved with it. But my frustration, actually, it's really funny, at the time was so much that the gaming was so unstructured that it wasn't clear what the limits were as to how much you let people get away with. And, you know, there were so many areas to fudge the play, and that was frustrating to me. So the idea of it, when I finally came to understand that a computer could be involved in this, then it's just the rules are set, and the system works the way it works, and if you live or die, that's just sort of the way it is. So there was something about that I felt brought some structure into the thing, and so to me it was sort of a perfect synergy between the kind of gaming I wanted. Now, there are limitations with the computer, but I thought we can ultimately exceed all those things and build enough intelligence into this that it feels just as natural as tabletop gaming, but structured like real life is where you can't get away. You have your magic, but you can't get away with things, and the dungeon master can't fudge it and, you know, do something he's not supposed to. So it sort of developed that way for me, and then the relationships that I built with some of the guys I met in high school playing Dungeons and Dragons.
So you talk about the lack of structure for tabletop RPGs. To me, that's always been kind of one of the appeals of the format, is that, you know, it does sort of come down to the quality of people you're playing with, but there is a, you know, the human element that's really hard to reproduce. And even now, I think, you know, there are some incredible, impressive RPGs on the market, you know, that have some great emotional storytelling, like Witcher 3.
Right.
But, you know, they're still sort of scripted.
Yes.
So I'm curious, like, you actually saw that at the time as something of a plus.
Yes.
for computers.
Yeah, well, I it's a trade-off. So I recognize that you're giving something up here. There is a dynamic quality, but I didn't feel like a lot of people that I were playing with were great storytellers anyway. So it wasn't – I didn't feel like I was losing a whole lot. But and I had this sense I could even do what I was doing, because I felt like my dungeons were really – complex and, you know, had a lot of cool story elements in it that would have been almost impossible to fit into an application. But I had that hope that it would ultimately be that. And, you know, in time, you know, I don't know, with the technology we have now, I think you could really almost do everything. But you're right. There's a human element, and there is if you have a really good dungeon master, there is something there that it's difficult to capture in any kind of software. But that's not what I found out there most of the time.
Okay.
So it was.
Well, it sounds, you know, from the way you described your the dungeons you created for tabletop games at your panel, it sounds like you kind of approach tabletop gaming as a sort of a multidisciplinary creator, not just like a writer, but also an artist and like a dungeon designer.
Yeah, and you know, I think part of it too was because of how I came into doing all this. I wasn't told how to do it. So to me, it was like, I'm going to make this a story. It's going to be an adventure. It's going to be like a great novel. It's going to have a visual component to it. So I was an artist. So I did really elaborate drawings, and I used the drawings. I fit things into the drawings. So it wasn't just window dressing. They were critical. And, you know, and I have guys like Brian Fargo, you know, studying the drawing. They're like, what's that right there? And they'd ask me, what's that thing we're seeing peeking out behind that rock right there? You know, and some of that stuff was relevant, and some of it I was just kind of messing with them in the drawing, because I knew they would scrutinize everything, you know, and then something would go wrong, and I say, "See, you missed this clue right here," and they love that stuff. So that it just became a lot of fun developing these visual and also complex puzzle solving sorts of adventures, and that was the thing that was so fun about it to me. And then combat was just sort of, you know, the flavoring that tied everything together, rather than what I was seeing coming out on a lot of these can campaigns, which were all just about, you know, fight after fight after fight after fight, where you're just fighting your way through some building or something like that, or some wilderness campaign. And it just wasn't very interesting to me. So mine were all more about a story. So there were a lot of NPCs in my adventures that would come to life and help you and provide special clues or keys to getting past certain things. I always did a lot of that. So when I finally got into, you know, developing some of these software things, I was always trying to implement those kind of ideas.
Mm-hmm. So, I guess you didn't approach dungeon design necessarily from, you know, like the top-down bird's eye view that most people do, but more from like a, like almost, you know, like one of those MacVenture games. I don't know if you've ever played, you know, the ICOM adventures like Shadowgate and that sort of thing, where, you know, it's kind of like you're traveling through a dungeon, but it's not, you know, it's not a top-down view. It's not a first-person viewpoint like in Bard's Tale. It's more of like scene to scene to scene, and it seems very much like the same kind of approach.
It is like that, and to whatever degree there was a top down, it was sort of not real important. It was more, you know, simplistic is the way I did it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I did want to make it make sense. So if you found a secret passageway, it did make sense to cut back to some other place in the adventure. So I did map some things out, but that was the least important part of it for me.
Yeah, in a way, it sounds kind of like your approach to tabletop gaming was similar to what the guys who founded Infocom did with Zork.
Yes.
And, you know, that was really an interpretation of the role-playing game in
itself,
except that instead of having combat where you have like two potential fights in the game, It was really built around solving the puzzles and looking at each, you know, the description of each room, you know, with the text description.
Absolutely. I played Zork, and that was the kind of game, that was the kind of gaming that I liked to do. So no question. And there was combat in there, but it was definitely intentional and not just like I'm putting three orcs here and five goblins here or something like that. That kind of stuff's boring to me.
Right. So kind of an artistic rendition of,
right,
kind of what they were doing with text adventures,
right,
at the time.
Right.
So this would have been like mid-70s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So right around the time that they were creating Zork. And
right.
Had you played Colossal Cave or Adventure or anything like that?
I played Adventure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't remember Colossal Cave, but I played Adventure.
It's the same game. It's just different names.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I played Adventure, and I played all the Scott Adams adventures when those things rolled out. Mm-hmm. Loved those. So that was all part of my early Apple kind of experience. But
you know, again, when it came time to create an RPG yourself, instead of going with that like story-driven approach, you definitely had some story elements to the Bard's,
right,
Tale, but you definitely drew more on Wizardry.
And I think Wizardry was such an influence, and it was more start with this and then what else can you bring into it than it was looking the other way. I couldn't see a path to getting that exactly, but I could see taking Wizardry and kicking it up five notches, and so that was why I ended up doing it that way. If this had all continued, you know, over time, it ultimately would have been something different. And when I eventually did Centauri Alliance, I did put more story elements, starting to do more of that at that point. But that it actually became rather complicated, which is what bogged that project down, is just the amount of animation and all the things like that. You know, Bard's Tale started off really simple, so and a lot of, you know, automated combat and things like that. So it made it easy to get the game done in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So nowadays, I mean, it's different. If I was working on it now, I'd be thinking more along the lines of the way I started all this, probably, mm-hmm, and a lot less on, you know, canned sorts of experiences.
Do you still play a lot of RPGs? Have you dabbled much in the recent ones?
The only game I've really played in recent years has been World of Warcraft. Mm-hmm. So I've played World of Warcraft in spurts at different points, but that's about it. And I tried a couple others, but I've not really found anything. And even World of Warcraft's got, you know, some flaws, but enough content that it was, there were points that it interested me. But mm-hmm. You know, I haven't really played a role-playing game that is really like, wow, this is it, to this point. I haven't had that experience. I just had this great visual experience, interactive experience playing Mage's Tale this last year, but that's really almost sort of another thing entirely.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I kind of see Mage's Tale as sort of a descendant of your own work.
Yes.
And I feel like, you know, it's sort of a few steps removed. You know, the interim steps would be something like Ultima Underground or, you know, Elder Scrolls or something, where you take,
right,
that first-person perspective and you put it into a fluid,
right,
first-person movement. And then, you know, you take that the next step and suddenly you're inside the virtual,
right,
reality experience.
Right, right. Yeah, I tried Elder Scrolls a little bit, but I've been so busy, it's been difficult to get into anything. But that was something that was interesting, and you know, I don't know, maybe I would have enjoyed it if I'd had time to sink into it. But
yeah, I feel like, you know, the Elder Scrolls games and stuff, you know, sometimes some of the stuff by BioWare does a pretty good job of kind of almost reproducing that human element that I was talking about, just because the games are these enormous sandboxes and there's so much to do and you take it at your own pace, that your experience is going to be different from everyone has a different path through the game. So it's not the same as, you know, having a GM like sit,
right,
there and calculate like, okay, what can I do to thwart them next? But
right,
maybe that's about as good as computers can make.
Maybe,
right,
maybe, yeah.
So before we get back, you know, too far into Bard's Tale, I wanted to ask about your influences in other spheres, like as an artist and illustrator. I don't know if you still do much illustrating now.
I didn't know. I stopped, you know, when I got into, I did up until the point where I was doing a lot of coding, and then I had a new creative outlet is the way I felt about it. But back in the day, I've always been a Marvel comic book collector. Mm-hmm. So I have still to this day tons and tons of X-Men and Spider-Man comics And that was a big thing for me, just doing comic kind of style illustration. And I, but then some of the art, like Frazetta's art on the Conan books and things like that, I was always really inspired by that. So it was probably a combination of those kind of things, sort of the science fiction fantasy cover art, and comic art was a big thing for me. Yeah, I've always been a comic aficionado. So,
yeah, I noticed those the illustrations that you showed yesterday reminded me a little bit of maybe like John Byrne or someone. I don't know if he was a big influence on you, but I'm assuming you also read like Conan comics.
Yes,
you know, the non superhero comics that still existed back in the
70s. Right, I did. Yeah, yep. That stuff had an effect. I actually collected a lot of stuff, and I think I collected some of his stuff, but I had a lot of. A lot of art that I was cutting from different things that I was scrapbooking and things back then and drawing. So, but that was where it all started for me. It was, that was a big part of my experience was illustrating. So for me, it all kind of blended together, you know, the gaming and the art and the comics and all of that.
Yeah. I mean, that is something that I think, you're kind of at the forefront there of seeing the computer as this sort of multimedia synthesis. And obviously, you know, the Apple II was only capable of so much. But, you know, you had companies like Rotorbund that were producing things, you know, like art programs, drawing programs for Apple II. And Apple was, you know, the Mac, I guess, came out the same year as Bartzeller, right around the same time.
Right
so,
around.
You know, that was really like an art-driven machine.
So. Yes, yes.
So it feels like Bartzeller was very much sort of its time in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I remember when the Mac came out too, and just I never thought that system was going anywhere. It's so funny when I first,
yeah, here I am.
When I first, yeah, yeah, no, it was really amazing at the time. I was there when it was rolled out. We were up in, I was up at an Electronic Arts Development Conference, and they were showing us, you know, some of the first systems coming out, and I just thought this is just not going to do it. And it was black and white then, you know, it wasn't even color, so I couldn't picture it. I thought Apple's gone wrong here on this whole thing, but then they righted it and they fixed it. So
yeah, so let's talk a little bit about Wizardry and the influence that had on you, because I look at the history of RPGs and I see games like Wizardry and some of the early Richard Garriott stuff like Akalabeth and Ultima, even Zork if you want to go there, is like the first wave of computer RPGs, and I feel like Bard's Tale kind of kicked off the second wave because, you know, it was a game inspired by what had come before in that medium, even though, you know, we're talking about a very compressed time period of like 3 or 4 years. Like, there's still, you know, enough time to look and process and synthesize and say, okay, I mean, you said yourself that the idea behind Bard's Tale was that you wanted to surpass the limits of wizardry.
Yes. No, that's absolutely it. I can't take credit for the framework for the way the game was set up. It was definitely an experience that I had playing Wizardry that was profound in a way on impact on me that it was like drawing a bunch of connection points for me between gaming in the past and, you know, what a computer moderated experience like that could be, but then it was just limited in so many ways. But had such a huge impact on me. I just loved the game, and as I was playing, I was just writing out constantly, thinking of ideas. I wish I could do this. I wish I could do that. And I was just generating a list because I thought, I think I can do this. I think I can actually write something that's like beyond this. I mean, I knew I could in a sense, but I was just inspired. And then I was thinking, I wonder if people would want to play this, because I sure would. And then I just kept going on it, rolling on it. And I had this thought, I think this could really be something big and people would be really, you know, intrigued if it was, you know, had three times the depth of Wizardry or something, you know, and better graphics and everything else. I think this would be really powerful. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely, I was standing on the shoulders of Woodhead there when he put that together. I mean, I think it was a brilliant, implementation of, you know, a Dungeons and Dragons experience, no question.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I recently interviewed Robert Woodhead about, you know, the creation of Wizardry, and he said that the game that they created, the very first Wizardry, used every single sector of a diskette for Apple II. Like, they couldn't have added anything more to the game. So, you know, wanting to say, like, going in and saying, I want to do this better, I want to make this bigger and badder, like, that was actually, you know, kind of pushing what the system could actually do. Like, did you realize at the time, or did you have sort of like the naivete of inexperience to just power you through?
Well, no. What I knew is that because he had written it in Pascal, so he's got this now big runtime engine that he's going to need to build this higher level language on. You just didn't writing a higher level. It's like writing in BASIC, you know. But the BASIC kernel was part of the Apple. Pascal, he had to have a software kernel that he had to read in. So I'm thinking all the overhead from this is what is making this so slow and so limited. Knowing that I'm a 6502 assembly language developer, I knew I could, I had, you know, it was like I had 10 times the room space he had to do this. So, I mean, maybe not 10 times, but 5 times the amount of space he had, plus the efficiency of machine code running through there, you know. So I knew it was going to be a lot faster, and I had a ton more, you know, system resources that I could put in there. But I was in that same spot. Even when it came down to Bardstell at the end, I was like down to sectors on there and like loading, you know, chunks of data into memory. I'd get down to where I'd be 15 bytes from the end, and I'd have to change monster names, you know, to make them shorter so that I could fit in another monster and still, you know, have it all there. And I came up with little compression algorithms for different pieces of data that were in there, because I ran out. So he really was, I think, limited because of the Pascal thing. And I knew just because of that that I had a ton more that I could offer.
Interesting. How did you know that it was coded in Pascal?
I don't remember how I knew. It was obvious. So it was either on the box or there was something that loaded maybe, and there was some telltale sign of it. But I don't remember how I knew, but I knew. Mm-hmm. So
that's something I don't think you really talked about yesterday, was how you got into programming and you know, how you learned 6502 machine language, which is, you know, that's, I wouldn't say esoteric. Like, it definitely had a lot of value in the Apple II era.
Right.
But, you know, that's still like not just a casual pick up and learn it kind of thing.
No, there was a funny thing. So Brian got an Apple II, and I was over at his house, and I walked in, and he said, "Hey, check." I go, "What's that?" And he said, "Oh yeah, my parents got me a computer." And I go, "What's that?" And because the only computers you know about in that time are the things that are in, you know, huge rooms, you know, sending the, you know, spacecraft up to the moon. So I'm like seeing this little thing. I had no understanding of it. And he started explaining it to me, and I'm like, "Wait a minute, you can tell it what to do?" And he's like, "Yeah, check this out." And he's showing me some BASIC. So he'd already been messing with it probably a week at that point. And right away I said, "Can we write games on this?" And he said, "Oh yeah, there are games on it." And anyway, so we started playing around with it, and that was the beginning of it. And then another friend of mine, these were my wealthy friends, okay? Because my parents, I told them, I said, "Hey, we got to get a computer," and they're like, "Why? What's that?"
Yeah, and we didn't own a computer until I was in high school.
So, right. And then my other friend, his parents got him one, and I was over at their house hanging out, and I'm just like getting time on their computer. I go, "Hey, could I, you know," I got dinner coming up. I go, "Could I just like sit in your room and, you know, like write some code?" So I was doing that and that's how, then as we were going, Brian and I started, we wrote this adventure together. Then we knew a guy who was doing some programming, who was more advanced than we were. He was, I think, maybe first year college, and he had a way of integrating graphics in with a text adventure format. And he taught us a little something about doing that. So then we started working on a combination image text adventure format. And then right about that time, I got hold of a book. It was like a self-published book by some guy on, you know, basic use of 6502 assembly language to do graphics. It was like he was a graphic programmer, and this thing was like printed on a Xerox machine or something, and I don't know, he was selling it, and I happened to get a copy of this, and I just absorbed it, and I was in short time like beyond the book and writing stuff. So that book, actually, and I don't remember what it was called, it was like Principles of 6502 Graphics or something, and it taught me everything I needed to know to sort of keep going on my own. Mm-hmm. And that was where that really, over the last year or so of high school, put me in a spot where I could, you know. And then the rest of game development I just pieced together myself, sort of the idea of a sort of integrated loop that kept running, you know, where you watch certain events and took certain actions and had certain background effects. All of that just sort of clicked in my mind. So I didn't have any formal training in any of that, but I figured it all out. Yeah. And so then by the first year of college, I was really just writing a whole number of different arcade action kind of games. Mm-hmm. And then I happened to get a copy of Wizardry, and that changed everything.
Things that I think sort of first wave RPG developers had in common was a lot of experience with like shared computing systems, colleges and that sort of thing. It doesn't really sound like you had that in your background. So
nope.
I wonder, do you think that sort of informed your approach to, or changed your approach to game design, like how you approached tackling the concept of a computer RPG versus someone who, you know, like Robert Woodhead had been on Plato Systems and done a lot of MUDs and that sort of thing back in the 70s.
Probably, yeah. I hadn't been involved with MUDs, so yeah, that probably would have changed my approach. My approach was more like this solo adventure kind of idea, this idea of me playing Dungeons & Dragons and not needing anybody else because the system would be the dungeon master. And this idea of, you know, individuals being able to game on their own rather than having to find a group of people and sit down at a tabletop, you know, that was the experience I was looking for and found through Wizardry and wanted to offer people on an even higher level. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, if I'd had more of that communal experience, you know, maybe I would have thought differently. And maybe also I would have had some ideas about, you know, multiplayer gaming, you know, down the line. But none of that occurred to me, really. The idea of integrating, you know, the internet as it started to unfold with some of that just wasn't something that made sense for me at the time. So
kind of revisiting that question, and you know, about the limitations of the Apple II and that sort of thing. Do you feel like technical limitations foster creativity? And if so, like, can you talk about how?
I think so. I think anytime you have a limited palette to draw on, you can when you reach the limits of one thing, you then can sort of put your back in that corner and focus on other things. And so by having very limited graphic and processing capability, it allowed, once you get comfortable with that, then you can spend all your time and energy thinking about content, thinking about gameplay and things like that. But if everything's unlimited in the sense of like the complexity of the interactivity and processing power and memory and disk space, it's difficult to know where to invest your time. You think, well, I can just make this look a little bit better. Maybe I should put more time into that, more time into that. Next thing you know, you've split your resources in a way which are maybe not going to end up with the best product in the end. And it's difficult not to, especially in today's world, want to make something look as good as possible. But in fact, you might be a lot better off stopping, saying this is good enough on how it looks. What is going to really make this fun and engaging for people? So I think that, yeah, I think that the limitations there made it easier to spend a lot of time and energy thinking about what is going to make this thing fun. And today, I think there's so many distractions in development that you don't really know where to sink your energy. That's my suspicion.
Yeah, that was something you said yesterday in your panel. Graphical complexity has taken over and replaced substance.
Yeah.
That's a pretty strong claim. Mm-hmm. Do you want to expand on that a little bit? Or, I mean, I don't know if you have examples or if it's just like a feeling you have.
Well, I mean, you can...
Not that I want you to necessarily call out other developers.
Oh, no. I don't want to. I think that... I don't really think that's fair. I think that the way I pointed it out yesterday when I was speaking is a good way, because I think it's intuitive for a lot of people. When we came to the Star Wars movies, I think that was a really good example where there was a human connection in the first three movies, despite the fact that the effects were rather weak, that the latter movies have not been able to recapture. The people, the characters, the actors and the characters that they portray, they draw us in, we identified with them. So we see ourselves in these people, so we become immersed in the storyline, and in their victory, we have a victory. So that was the experience of the first three Star Wars movies. I think in their victory, we find victory, and we have an experience of that victory. And then you have the next three movies, and you just can't relate to anybody in these movies. And the graphics were amazing. The complexity of the world that was built was amazing, but there was no human connection really. And the people, most of them, do I hate this person? Do I like this person? But I don't relate to this person. Now, all of that was missing, and apparently Lucas had no sense of how to draw people into the story any longer, except but if we make it look amazing, I'm sure people will really love this. But and this is, I think this is a seduction of technology, is in thinking, if I just make something more complicated, it's going to have a bigger impact on people, whereas in fact, that's not the way we relate as people. So today, my son plays a lot of these games. He calls them pixel games. You know, they're kind of these retro gaming style where everything's blocky, like a Minecraft sort of experience. And, you know, a lot of people look at that and go, wow, this is, why would anybody even want to play a game like this? But it's the graphics are secondary. And I think that that's something that a lot of people miss today. I think it's being missed in Hollywood, and it probably is missed a lot in gaming, but I wouldn't call anybody out. But there are points where I really feel like they're not thinking about what makes something fun and what engages people. They're thinking more about, you know, how to make this more complex, or how to make the world bigger, or how to make it as hard as possible, instead of how do I draw people in experientially. So they see themselves in the game, they project themselves into it, they identify with the story, they identify with the non-player characters and things like that.
But clearly, you're not averse to graphical experiences, as much as you have said great things about Mage's Tale, which is very much, you know, like an experience, a graphical, oriented, immersive VR game.
In a perfect world, the graphics are amazing, and you don't sacrifice any of these other things. So that's it. The ideal world. The perfect world is one where the graphics are so amazing you don't even remember that this isn't the real world. And so when we achieve that, which is achievable in VR, especially as the technology improves, it's going to take gaming along with it. But does that then take the place of everything else that really matters and what makes a game immersive and powerful and life-changing for people? And I think that's the problem, is people put their energy, time, focus on one thing and don't do the other thing, or they don't know how to do the other thing. I mean, how did Lucas not do that again in the movies? Did he not know what made those movies good for people? Or we can't know. I mean, I don't know. Maybe you interview him and ask him, or maybe you ask him for me, because I'm interested in knowing why he didn't understand why those movies were so good, because he apparently didn't. So,
you know, I think the Star Wars prequels show the importance of collaboration and knowing your own weaknesses. Like, Lucas has said in interviews that he's not a great storyteller, that he thinks in terms of structure and technical things. And, you know, the prequels were great in those senses. But in terms of, like, directing humans and, you know, Ewan McGregor is a really good actor, but there's only so much he can do when he's staring at a rubber Jar Jar head in front of a green screen.
Right.
So, yeah, like, I think he just needed to loosen up a little bit and let other people direct and let other people have more input.
Maybe.
And I think that's, you know, I think when you get great games, a lot of times, you know, games now, you know, when the expectations and technology is so much more complex than when you made Bard's Tale, it really does come down to not one person's vision, but many people, like, understanding how to work together to realize a vision.
Well, and this is another problem. I think that, like, the more people that you have involved, maybe the more difficulty in getting, like, a coherent vision realized is there. Because when you've got, you know, a huge team of people, back in the day when I was doing this stuff, there weren't big teams. It was mostly one person did the work, and you had people that would support you with graphics or sound or whatever, but it was predominantly one person coding and designing and coming up with things. That was very typical back at that time, and that's almost, I would think, unheard of nowadays. And the productions are so massive that you couldn't do that. So letting somebody sort of be out front, be the star, and sort of carry most of the weight, I think, to the degree that that has happened, because there are some really brilliant designers that have sort of carried some of these designs. You see some of the best designs when their visions really hit with people, and those are the ones you tend to take notice of, and the designers that you tend to think of as sort of the rock stars doing it. Nowadays, it's just harder, though, because I think there's a team mentality, and it could be that you know, sort of one vision that carries everything never really has a chance to come to life because there are so many people involved in the production. So,
yeah, I mean, you see a lot of that now with independent games, that, like, one person's vision. And maybe meaningfully, a lot of those games have graphics that are really not that much more advanced than what you put together in 1984 for Bard's Tale. Something like Undertale, which is really just one person's creation, has really resonated with people, you know, all around the world, because it tells this really interesting story that kind of inverts a lot of expectations about video game narratives and video game design. But I don't know that that would have worked at a, you know, at a large scale. Like, if this had been a AAA game,
it wouldn't have come to life the same way. Mm-mm.
So I want to kind of running a little bit out of time, but I do want to put together two things that you said in your panel yesterday that I think speak a lot to the design of the Bard's Tale. You said magic lets you extend yourself in ways that should be impossible, speaking in terms of, like, you know, game mechanics and the vision for Bard's Tale. And you also later said technology allows us to transcend human limitations. I kind of feel like those are two very closely related statements.
They are. Yeah, I think that my thesis is that this is part of what people want in life. This is sort of the way people tick. They want to exceed limitations. They want to be more than they are. They want to be everything that they feel they should be. And technology is our attempt to realize that. And we use devices to try to overcome limitations, to sort of compress time and space, to be multiple places, to, you know, nowadays you can be on the other side of the world without moving at all. It's that idea. And a lot of technology is really implemented for that purpose. And magic is really a way of doing that also. So in a game context, which I think why science fiction and fantasy blend together so well, is because those things are utilized for the same purpose and to give us this same experience. So me and my games, I wanted magic to be the center point of the game, and I wanted people to have that sense of becoming everything they want to be. I say immortal and unbeatable, to, you know, sort of have power over the circumstances of life. And magic gives you that. Technology gives you that. And so we can deliver that experience in the context of a game. So as I'm developing a game, I'm always thinking, how do I deliver that experience to people where they feel like I've just, and I even create limitations in a game so that I can give people the magical power to then transcend it and have this experience of, like, I just lifted myself to this higher level. So it's kind of a positive realization of, you know, an experience of fulfillment and destiny is this experience I always wanted to leave people with, because that's the thing I got. And I got that from Wizardry. So, or at least a taste of it from Wizardry. And I wanted to deliver that in my game. So anytime I'm designing, I'm always thinking in those terms, you know, helping people to have an experience of being like the best they can be, even better than they would have imagined through their character and sort of their immersion in the game.
Mm-hmm. I guess kind of as a corollary to that, you also mentioned something about, you know, in terms of the game design, you created boundaries and limits in order to create opportunities to surpass them. So I feel like that all feeds into this idea of, you know, like ascending to a higher plane.
Yes.
So
it's kind of like with my kids, you know, it's like setting rules and limitations for your kids so that you can reward them when they do well. And then they have a certain experience of accomplishment, you know, and responsibility in that. And so that experience in life of setting limits and but then having a way to exceed them is there's a certain experience. And that experience is like, I think, intrinsic to being human. And I think when you, in a game, you can deliver that intentionally by setting a limit in the game. You can't do this unless you happen to have a certain magical power, magical item, and then giving that to them. It's contrived, but it gives people that experience. And then as they progress up, they find themselves more projected into the game.
Right. Yeah, I think it's interesting that you talk about this sort of like elevation and, you know, becoming the Archmage in Bard's Tale 2. And around the same time that you created the Bard's Tale, Ultima 4 came out, and that is a game very much about sort of similar motifs, you know, about ethics and morality and about setting a good example and you know, ascending to become the Avatar.
Mm.
I am assuming you didn't, you know, interact at all with Richard Garriott as you were making
I didn't
this.
Interact with him, no, but I played the games as I was playing. That was, Ultima was one of the games I played a lot of back in that time frame. I don't remember a whole lot about it now, but I remember playing it a great deal, which is why I built the capability of loading Ultima characters into Bard's Tale ultimately, because I had characters that I could roll over myself doing that. So Wizardry and Ultima were the games I was playing. So yeah, but I never met the guy. Okay. And
but it's interesting that you both sort of arrived at the same destination mm-hmm, independently mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. I don't think, you know, Ultima 1 through 3 really spoke to what he would do with Ultima 4. It was such a big departure.
Right.
And, you know, that was a 1984 game also.
Right.
So I'm assuming you didn't play Ultima 4 and then say, oh, I've got to start adding this to the hard stuff.
No, I got it. Like I said in my talk yesterday, I got a lot of this sense of from Lord of the Rings, and I did have sort of a meta sense after those books of realizing what he was doing in those books and what his goal was in the development of the characters in the books and drawing the reader into the book. And so I knew his general strategy, and I thought, this is what I want. This is the kind of adventure I would want to build also, to draw people in this way. So that was an undercurrent in my design. And maybe it was with Garriott also. Maybe he had similar kind of inspiration. I don't know.
Well, I think he was partially inspired by the moral panic surrounding RPGs. And I thought it was interesting that you, in your panel, mentioned, taking a Christian worldview on things and talked about, you know, pulling influences from the Bible in terms of names for Bard's Tale 2. As a kid who grew up going to church every week, I kind of, you know, in the early 80s, I got a sort of front row seat to the moral panic surrounding RPGs. And,
right.
And for the longest time, like, I was always hearing, you know, Dungeons and Dragons is evil. You shouldn't, you know, be involved in that. I didn't buy it,
right?
But I certainly saw a lot of it. I'm wondering if, like, did you have a lot of experience with that?
Yeah. My mom was down on it actually at the time. Gave me a hard time about Dungeons and Dragons, but I said, listen, Mom, you're missing this because Tolkien was a Christian and C.S. Lewis was a Christian, and the Narnia books are the same genre as this. And I said that the issue's not the game itself, but what you do, it's the content in the thing. So, you know, so I dealt with some of that, and I mostly didn't pay attention to it. But it's like how it is today. I mean, you know, you're going to have games and movies that are going to, the genre doesn't matter. It's what you do with the genre. So, you know, you've got Narnia and you've got, you know, Game of Thrones, and my kids watch one and not the other. Right. So it's like that. So you just make good choices, you know, and I knew that at the point. So yeah, so my approach was, it would never have even occurred to me to put sort of unsavory things into the game. That's not the way I'm wired. And, if anything, I think sort of undermines this idea that I was trying to talk about, it just sort of ascending to this higher level. Why not? That, I mean, that's becoming all that you're supposed to be, means not becoming something you probably shouldn't be and isn't good for you anyway. So let's give people positive and leave out the negative, and people aren't going to feel deprived because they become some amazing Destiny Knight hero and not, you know, some, you know, slave trader or something like that. Oh, I wish I could have been a slave trader or something. No, nobody, you know, I just don't need to deliver that experience. I don't think that's as fun to me.
Well, I was also wondering, did you have to deal with bearing the brunt of that sort of public outcry against RPGs with the Bard's Tale, or did that kind of pass over?
Yeah, I never heard anything. I never heard anybody say anything to me like, you shouldn't be working in this or doing these kind of games or anything like that. At the point that I was finally doing the games, my mom had, you know, was... I was out of the house, so I didn't have to deal with her anymore, her criticism. And later on, of course, she had a completely different mindset about it. So it was all fine. But I never had anybody say anything critical to me. I've had people over the years say, hey, listen, my parents were upset that I was playing some of these games, but then I was able to show them my copy of Bard's Tale 2 with the biblical cities on it, and they said, oh, okay, this must be all right. I've been told that a number of times. So great, you know. If that got somebody out of trouble, that's terrific.
All right. Well, we need to wrap this up for time, but, you know, just to wrap up, you haven't really been working on games in a long time, but you mentioned, you know, kind of wanting to get back into the industry. And, like, do you have any thoughts about where you'd like to go with a project?
Well, you know, recently I've done a number of games. They're voice interactive role-playing games for the Amazon Alexa. Okay. And the company, if anybody's interested, the company is Daysfly, daysfly.com. And I've done three games right now. One's a kid game, one's kind of an easy role-playing game, and then one's a full combat, probably takes 20 hours to solve, extensive role-playing game. And I'm looking to do some more stuff along those lines. But I have been asked recently if I'd be interested in coming back into the gaming industry, and I would take a good hard look at an opportunity to do that. And I would see myself in more of a creative role at this point, because the technology and software architecture I've been involved with up to this point is so removed that I couldn't take a year to get back up to speed on, you know, the latest game engine. So I'd be looking for more of a design role probably if I got back into it.
That collaboration.
Yeah.
Like everyone should know their strengths.
Right. So yeah, no, I'd be open to it. And I haven't thought a whole lot about it, but just with some of these other projects I've been working on now, I'm finding myself, you know, more interested in this again. And so I might look at something if an opportunity popped up.
All right. Well, thank you for your time and for your responses. That was Michael Cranford, creator of The Bard's Tale.
And that wraps it up for this episode of Retronauts.
Pluto TV is the leading free streaming television service. Watch more than 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all for free. No credit card needed and no sign up. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies. What are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again. Download Pluto TV for free on all your favorite devices today.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.